ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Saturday Extra with Nick Bryant.
In 1776, the American colonies declared their independence from Britain. And July the 4th is the country's birthday. So join me, Nick Bryant, for our America at 250 series. Conversations on how the past continues to animate the present with historians and thinkers such as the legendary documentary maker Ken Burns. Search for Saturday Extra on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
He's seen as the big screen's first action hero. Handsome, charismatic, a Tasmanian, famous for his swashbuckling characters, his smouldering sexuality in the golden age of Hollywood. But was there a dark side to Errol Flynn? The true story of a Hollywood icon. That's today on Big Ideas. Hello, welcome. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Get in touch while you're listening. The Radio National text line 0418 226 576. Our email, bigideas@abc.net.au. Professor Patricia O'Brien is an historian at Georgetown University. She has a revealing new biography out about this Hollywood high flyer. Errol Flynn starred in countless classics. Think The Adventures of Robin Hood, Captain Blood, thrillers, romantic comedies, westerns, war dramas. He did them all. Often forgotten, though, is what happened when the cameras weren't rolling. The womanising, relationships with underage girls, the rape trial. Diving into the celebrity and the scandals, warts and all, Patricia joins Frank Bongiorno today, director of the Vice-Chancellor's Centre of Public Ideas at the University of Canberra, where he's also the Donald Horne Professor of History and Public Ideas. So let's head to the Australian National University on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country for this event in its Meet the Author series.
Your previous book was a biography of a Samoan nationalist leader, Taisi O.F. Nelson. How did you get from there, anti-colonialism in Samoa, to Errol Flynn and Tasmania?
Actually, it was Errol Flynn that led me to Taisi O.F. Nelson. I owe Errol Flynn a lot of thanks because he has been the inspiration for a lot of my historical work. I had a fellowship in Wellington and I was finishing up an article that was inspired by Errol. It was about the Nakanai massacre, which he claimed that he had participated in colonial New Guinea. And I was finishing up that article, and because I was in Wellington, I had to look at League of Nations records. And when I was looking at the League of Nations records, I kept coming upon all these references to Taisi O.F. Nelson, who was causing immense consternation for these officials in New Zealand. And I kept thinking, well, who's this man? Who's this person that they're all getting upset about, and why don't I know about him? That's how I found Taisi O.F. Nelson, who happened to be an extraordinarily consequential figure, not only in the Pacific, but also in the world. And, yeah, so that kind of went from there.
It's quite a pathway, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, and I should say, I mean, this makes me sound like a real nerd, but I have a favourite document. Have you got a favourite document?
I can't think of one off the top of my head, but please go ahead.
Well, my favourite document is the Pacific Islands Monthly in 1936. Actually has articles about both Taisi O.F. Nelson and Errol Flynn. So I must get that framed.
Now, he was almost certainly the most famous Tasmanian of all time, I think. Mm. I think I also described as, well, the most famous Australian of his time and the most famous Tasmanian of all time. How does he end up being born in Tasmania, of all places?
Yeah, that really happens because of his father's career. He had no ties to Tasmania. His family didn't have ties to Tasmania, and it was just his father, who had just graduated an undergraduate degree in biology from the University of Sydney. He was appointed to the University of Tasmania in the biology department. in about March, I think, 1909. So his mother was, very pregnant. He was born in June. And they moved to Tasmania, and that's how he came to be born there.
So give us a picture of the young Errol, no doubt an extremely wholesome church-going figure, I would imagine.
He was baptised.
Very gentlemanly and all the rest of it. Tell us, what was he like? I mean, growing up in Tasmania, obviously spending a part of his youth also younger years in Sydney. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the young Errol Flynn.
So his childhood was one that has very sort of distinct periods. So there was the happy childhood days where he was in Tasmania. He loved following his father around as he did all his scientific work, and he did lots of fun things, and he loved tagging along with him. His youth also involved a lot of travelling up to Sydney because his family, extended family, were there. So there's a lot of moving up to Sydney. And then in 1920, when he was about 11, his family left Australia because of his father's career. His father had made a big discovery of a dinosaur, a dinosaur whale, and that sort of took him to England. And so that began a really sad, sort of heartbreaking time in Errol's life when he kind of got marooned in a couple of British boarding schools. And that was a really sad time because his parents actually split up when they arrived to London. And his parents actually lived apart for about 7 years. His mother lived with a man in France and his father moved back to England. So Errol remembers those years as sort of these torturous years. You know, it's heartbreaking because you think he's like a young teenage boy left at these boarding schools and no one took him away on school holidays. He stayed there. He was the only kid left at school. And he says that sort of had this, very scarring effect on him. And then his father did come and get him, and then they returned to Tasmania for a while. He kept going on at school, but he was not very good at school. He said he never passed an exam in his life. And then he finished his schooling in Sydney at the Shaw School, and that was sort of the end of his youth. That was in 1926. And then he goes to New Guinea as a young man.
So what does it mean, for Errol Flynn to have grown up in, I guess you call Federation era Australia? I mean, one of the things you do extremely well and thoroughly in the book, Paddy, is you give a sense of that context of place. How does place matter for our understanding of Errol Flynn?
I think it matters a lot. The influences that he had in Australia growing up, I think, were really profoundly important. I mean, apart from his family, which, there was a lot of problems there, which I go into. The place, there was this great love of Tasmania, great love of nature, a great love of the outdoors, something that he really followed through life, and it sort of took it onto the screen as this, sort of this action hero that he was. But I think also the context of the times was really important because of all the, and particularly when he goes to New Guinea, and this is the time of Australia's formal colonisation of New Guinea, and this has a huge impact on him too, and the circles that his father moved in, because he worked at the university, he also worked at the, was attached to the University of Tasmania. So all of that presentation of colonial history, the past, scientific racism, all of those things had a really big impact on him and really shaped him.
It's the age of high empire, I guess, isn't it? And which also gives rise to certain ways of being a man, I guess, imperial masculinity. I mean, is that an important part, do you think, of his upbringing down in Tasmania?
I think definitely. There was very, and I think this very much comes from his father, that his father had, if you, you can go and read his articles, he often talks about the white man. His father was very influenced by these ideas about race and what a white man should be. And I think that incubator, that cultural incubator for Errol was very important.
So take us to New Guinea next. This is an extraordinary period, really, in his life, and formative in all sorts of ways, also a source of great, well, of tall stories, it has to be said.
Yes.
So what part does New Guinea play in the Errol Flynn story?
It's a huge part. The persona that he takes to Hollywood, which is, you know, this huge leap from colonial New Guinea to Hollywood in 2 years, he really hones his frontier masculinity there. This man who's living the life of adventure, living the life of colonial heroes. But his life in New Guinea, there's a lot of tall stories. There's a lot of embellishing the truth there about what he did. So that massacre that I mentioned at the beginning, the Nakanai massacre, he claimed that he'd been on that as a government officer just after he arrived in New Guinea. And he goes into graphic detail about the massacre and the things that he saw. It was a massacre by local people of 4 Australian gold seekers in the Nakanai region in 1926. And Errol Flynn goes into graphic detail. He writes about it numerous times. And the problem was with the story that the massacre happened before he got there. But there were other stories too about what he did. So he ran plantations. He ran copra plantations.
That's using the term "ran" very loosely, though, isn't it? Did he sort of lounged about a bit and things? Is that right?
Yes. Yes. He didn't.
It was a leisurely running of the plantations.
Yes. He oversaw the large indigenous labour force and had to sort of intervene at certain times. But his method for running the first plantation was very much that he would instruct the overseer about what to do. And then he went fishing or something. Yeah. He had another plantation later in Papua, at a place called Lalokai, and he actually, I think, worked that one because I think he wasn't hired help then. He had more, skin in the game at that plantation. It was a tobacco plantation, and he did more work there. But he also did labour recruiting and, other odd jobs, ran a boat service and things like that. So he learnt a lot of things, particularly the skill of sailing. That was something that he really learnt when he was in New Guinea. And then his first moment of publicity was when he and 3 friends sailed from Sydney to Papua in 1930 on the boat the Sirocco.
And he's already kind of cultivating a kind of celebrity, isn't he, in that early period, and a certain image, I guess. I mean, there was a kind of ill-fated engagement, for instance, in Sydney, and
it's two
ill-fated engagements in Sydney. So there's a sense in which, Hollywood lives on images, doesn't it, and ideals and all the rest of it, and he's already sort of involved in a kind of DIY process of that at quite a young age, isn't he?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that he does in New Guinea that's really important, actually, is that he starts writing for publication. So he writes for the Bulletin, and he writes for some other publications too. And then he takes that skill and writes in when he gets to Hollywood as well. And he uses his time in New Guinea as sort of like the source of all these stories. So there's lots of writing about New Guinea and his experiences there.
It's that kind of imperial adventure type mode, isn't
yes.
it, really, in a way? Yeah. So, look, how does he become a film star? I mean, as you say, it is quite extraordinary, the rapidity, I suppose, of this rise to stardom. How does it happen? How does he get into film? How could I get into film? No. I mean, I just want to... how does it happen? How does it happen?
Well, Errol Flynn is really blessed with a lot of good luck.
And a lot of good looks too.
And good
which
looks.
Is, I imagine,
he's very,
part
he's,
of the story.
Yeah, he's yeah. very good looking. Yeah. And this is how it really starts, is that he is discovered on Bondi Beach by someone working for Charles and Elsa Chauvel, who are making their film In the Wake of the Bounty in 1932. And they need someone to play Fletcher Christian. And none of the actor rosters in Sydney really fit the part, because one of the advances in this film was that it was a talkie film, so they needed someone who fit the image of this imperial epitome of British masculinity who also had a great speaking voice. And so Errol was, this was one of his trips back to Sydney. He was on Bondi Beach and he was spotted, and he then went and had a drink with Charles Chauvel, and then he shot these scenes of Fletcher Christian. And Elsa Chauvel was very prescient, because back then she said, you know, he's untrained, and, you know, she thought he was a planter from the Solomon Islands, but, you know, it's New Guinea. But she said, oh, he's much better looking than a lot of those, any other Australian actor, and also those matinee idols in Hollywood. So she knew what she was talking about.
An eye for talent.
Yeah, and then he goes back to New Guinea and labour recruits after that, and then he leaves Australia. That was his last time in Australia. Then he goes to New Guinea, and in 1933 he leaves New Guinea and he travels to Britain, because his family have relocated there. His father now has a chair at Queen's University in Belfast. And he goes to Belfast, and he doesn't stay there long. His parents have just reunited, and not very happily. He leaves and he starts acting. He starts working for a theatre.
Live theatre.
Yeah, live theatre. But he also shoots a couple of films, and again, this sort of serendipity that he gets a cast in one of these, they're called quickie movies, that Warner Brothers in London, the Teddington Studios, they shoot these movies to just sort of basically harvest talent from the British Isles, and he's in one of these. And the talent scout is like, okay, this guy's got it, you know, you better sign him up. And so at the end of 1934, he's put on a boat in London, and he sails to New York and then on to Hollywood.
Yeah, he finds things to occupy himself on the boat, though, on the ship, as I recall.
Yes, he does. He meets some very glamorous ladies, because on the SS Paris, he sees his future wife, Lily Demeter. He also sees Merle Oberon on that boat as well, and he gets a bit closer to a few other actresses.
Tell us about them.
Tell
us about both of those women.
Okay, well, so Lily Demeter, she's a very major figure in the story, and you could say that, again, she was, you know, she's the person who made Errol rocket to this sort of seemingly instant fame, and it was pretty instant, because she was a French film star. She'd had a career in Europe, particularly in silent films. She was renowned as a sex symbol. This was before the, you know, censorship kind of killed these incredibly raunchy films, and she starred in these, and then she was just making her move into Hollywood. Met Flynn, and they married in June 1935. So just after he's arrived in Hollywood, he marries. He had escaped a few engagements in Australia, but he's not able to sort of escape that one. But it's actually very fortuitous, because she gets him cast in his first starring role.
It's a good career move for him, because she is such a celebrity herself, right?
Yes, yeah. And he gets noticed because he's the one who's married this. So I have a chapter in the book called Mr. Lily Demeter, but he's not Mr. Lily Demeter for long, because of the huge success of Captain Blood.
And Merle Oberon?
Merle Oberon, I mean, I'm not an expert on Merle Oberon. Angela Woolacott is, who used to be here. But Merle Oberon is a really fascinating person. She's actually been getting quite a bit of publicity in the United States. She was born to a very young woman, I think from Sri Lanka, and a British man. So she had this Hollywood career, but in order to disguise her roots, she said she came from the most obscure place in the world, which was Tasmania.
Another one.
So no one else came from Tasmania. She said she was from Tasmania, but Errol was really from Tasmania. Yeah,
he put it around, he was Irish, and I presume it's a time in Belfast that's the origin of that, isn't it? Is that right?
That was the studios. There was no cachet in being Australian.
He kind of went along with it, though, didn't he?
It's a very weird thing, you know, that manufacturing a palatable backstory, an interesting backstory, and the studios decided he was going to be Irish. Yeah. And, of course, a name like Flynn and having, you know, family in Belfast, it kind of fit. But then when he was trying to explain how he came to be in Papua New Guinea and sailing from Sydney and all the other things he claimed, like being a Olympic boxing champion and all kinds of other things, it becomes rather convoluted. But he does try to maintain this fiction that he's from Ireland. But and in the press at the time, some people, you know, go with the studio line, but in a lot of the Australian press, they know that he's, you know, from...
They know who he is. They know he's one of them. From. He's one of us, yes.
Tasmanian-born Errol Flynn was the man who had it all, who every man wanted to be in Hollywood's golden age, diving behind the facade, as she does in her book, Errol Flynn, The True Story of Australia's Hollywood Icon, is Georgetown University historian Patricia O'Brien, who is also an honorary associate professor in the Department of Pacific Affairs at the ANU, which is where ABC Radio National's Big Ideas comes to you from today at this event hosted by historian Frank Bongiorno from the University of Canberra. Back to more on this life lived to excess, a life that the modern Me Too movement would have shone a light on for sure.
So take us through that early period in the 30s. I mean, what are the big breakthroughs for him in film?
I mean, the first one is Captain Blood, the film that is his first big Hollywood film where he's got the leading part. And that's released in December 1935. And it becomes a huge hit. It's a massive hit. It's a great film. You know, he's got a sword in his hand. There's scenes when he's a galley slave, which means he has to have his shirt off.
It's a bit like Mr. Darcy, isn't it? Colin Firth, yes. Mm. Yes.
Yeah, so all of these narrative reasons for showing a bit of skin, that's Captain Blood. It's such a big hit. And then after that, there's a series of these huge films, like Charge of the Light Brigade. They do some other films where people don't like them so much. People like his adventure films. I mean, Charge of the Light Brigade is really something to behold if you haven't watched it, just for the scenes on horses. Mm. I mean, really incredible. But there's a horrible kind of backstory to that because the director put tripwire down to sort of make the horses fall and it was pretty cruel. Yeah, so there was all these films that came out, but then there was Robin Hood, which was just such a massive film.
And it's spectacular in its appearance.
In Technicolor.
In its budget, which was, I think, what the most expensive film of all time at that stage, wasn't it? It was certainly very, very lavish.
Well, the thing all of Errol's films, and particularly when he's writing back to his family, he's always... Every film is like, this is the biggest budget film Warner's has ever made. Mm. Robin Hood was, you know, a phenomenal film, and then that was followed up with a whole lot of other films.
So tell us, Patty, this is a very important question, your favourite Errol Flynn film. Mine is Uncertain Glory, 1944,
yes.
End of the War. In which we won't do the plot, but anyway, it's set in France. He's a crook and he escapes the guillotine. He's about to be executed and then kind of, we won't give it away, but he kind of redeems himself through his courageous behaviour. But I remember watching it when I was younger and thinking, gee, this guy really could act. Mm. I mean, there was a real emotional depth, I thought, to his acting there. But tell us yours.
Well, it's not the one I've... The film I saw, I have seen most of, because I used to watch the films with my kids when they were little, and their favourite film was Desperate Journey, where Errol actually plays an Australian. He plays... It's one of the first film where he plays an Australian. He plays an Australian airman, and he stars in that film with... he didn't get equal billing with Errol, but Ronald Reagan plays the American airman. I think Ronald Reagan got third or fourth billing in that film. So that was the one I've seen the most often, because that was the one the boys loved. Yeah. But the film, I mean, I love Robin Hood.
Marvellous, yeah.
I love the Seahawk. But I think the film that I think that he was really good in is The Edge of Darkness, which was one of his World War II films. And he plays a Norwegian fisherman, I suppose. The plot is about the Nazi assault on Norway. And so it's part of the Norwegian resistance to the invasion. But I'm troubled by that, because that was a film that he shot during his trial.
And we'll get to that in a moment. But I want you to give us a picture of Errol before that. I don't know if it's even accurate to call it the fall, as it turned out, but give us a picture of Errol Flynn at the height of his fame, which I think really is probably in the early 40s in a way, and the height of his powers in many respects too. What's he like? What's his world like?
Well, his world is very glamorous. You know, he's got so much money. He's got beautiful clothes. He's got the cars. He buys a property early on, which then becomes Mulholland Farm, and he builds a house on it. But after he's separated from Lily Demeter, he's known about town to be being very friendly to ladies.
Especially younger ones.
Yes. He's having a very good time. It's complete, you know, whatever he... There's no kind of restraint on what he's doing, because he's making so much money for the studios, even though there are sort of morality clauses and so forth. I mean, he gets a pass on everything because he's making so much money. And that sex symbol's image really sort of burnishes who's coming to the cinema and getting people to buy tickets. And he gets this... he's got this incredible fan range, which is men. A lot of men love Errol because he really appeals to them. But he also appeals to this really broad female demographic, from young teenage girls right through to more elderly ladies.
So tell us about that kind of, that fall from grace, I guess, in 1942. What's it all about? What happens? How does it happen? What's the outcome?
Yeah, it's a complicated story, but basically Errol Flynn is charged with statutory rape in 1942. He's charged firstly with the rape of one young girl at a party that was hosted by his friend, Freddie McAvoy. And then he's charged a few days later with two other counts of statutory rape for an incident that happened the previous year on his boat, his American boat called the Sirocco, which he named after his boat that he sailed from Sydney to Papua in. So there was a series of legal events. It was really driven by the district attorney at the time, who, even though the grand jury didn't want to pursue charges, the district attorney overruled. And Errol Flynn, you know, was put on trial, and the trial started in January 1943. And it was a massive sensation, this trial. It was, you know, had saturation coverage. It competed. This was going on at the same time as the Battle of Guadalcanal. And there's sort of like competing headlines about what was happening in Guadalcanal and Errol Flynn's trial. Huge numbers of women tried to get into the courtroom, you know, the whole perp walk thing, like women wanting to see him. And, you know, it was an incredible
circus.
See, basically. It was a circus inside and outside the courtroom. Yeah. And it's a really brutal story for these young girls.
So they're teenagers, basically.
Yeah, they're teenagers, yeah. Yes. Yeah. They really become very, you know, unwilling participants in what turns out to be sort of like a theatrical performance. And Errol Flynn really approaches it like a performance, and there's this whole sense that, you know, and deliberate trying to evoke his films and moments in his films. So by the time that he's on trial, he's done a number of films where he has this set piece where he has a speech crying out for justice, you know, pleading for justice. And so the whole trial becomes reality and fiction become very blended. And the studio's realizing at the time that this is actually great for business. More people go to his films because of the trial. They had to keep Desperate Journey going at the cinemas a bit longer. And also people really started to feel that he was being persecuted. And so there was this, you know, this real, almost like a burning at the stake of these young girls, you know, really extraordinarily brutal. And the other element is that most of the jurors were matronly ladies, and the prosecution actually wanted matronly ladies on the jury because they were absolutely certain that they would sympathise with Errol Flynn rather than these teenage girls.
Put the teenage girls on trial, effectively.
Yeah, these women were, you know, very much agents of, you know, torturing these girls, and gave Errol a massive pass and thought he was persecuted. The fact that he had this reputation as a Lothario was irrelevant. You know, all that mattered was about the girls' sexual histories and, you know, what they'd done and so on and so forth. So he was acquitted, and he ended up making, you know, so much more money and was really rewarded by it. And there's this really poignant letter where he writes to his parents and he says, you know, the trial was a real ordeal, but, you know, I've come out of it better.
Yeah. So this wasn't a Me Too moment. I mean, in some ways, at that point in his career, I mean, his best is behind him. We can see in retrospect, even though it didn't perhaps look like that at the time. Rock Bottom would arrive, and pretty soon. What did Rock Bottom look like, and how did he get there?
Yeah, so the trial was one thing. So yeah, on the one hand, he got this reward, he got more money, he became more famous. People, you know, the adulation levels sort of went way up because he'd gone through this, you know, seemingly persecution, but. Just before the trial, he'd also been rejected for military service. He'd become an American citizen right before the trial, and he was rejected for military service. So this was at the time when he was appearing in films like Gentleman Jim, where he was a boxer, again, you know, shirt off, you know, not... And he was, you know, an extraordinarily fit, perfect kind of looking person. And he got rejected for military service. And the reason why was because he had tuberculosis and because he had a heart condition. So he was rejected for military service. And that was something that did not sit well with him. He did not like the fact that he wasn't able to join the, you know, all the legions of men fighting. So with the trial, with that he couldn't step up and fight, and he did really, he really wanted to, I think, because his parents were living in the Blitz in Belfast. His father was heavily involved in sort of the civilian relief efforts there. He got an OBE after the war because of his efforts. So, but Errol wasn't able to be part of it, and I think that was a real affront to his masculinity. And also he's had some film roles where he's been injured. Drug use was something that was very common.
And it's on to heroin, right?
Yes. Yeah. So he starts with, you know, probably Speed, which was, you know, prescribed for actors so they could be, you know, do the long hours and be sparkling all the time. But then he moves into much more serious drugs. He's drinking, and then he moves into narcotics.
And a succession of teenage girls along the way.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. He has, yes. So while he's on trial, he's got a teenage girl at his house. And then he meets his second wife. She's working at a kiosk at the courthouse, and he invites her to the house, but she's underage. And yes, so and then he ends up marrying her, a very strange marriage, but because she's pregnant and she has a daughter.
The last thing I wanted to ask you, Patty, really is about why Errol should matter to us now. I mean, why does this story, I mean, it's obviously a fascinating story and that's its own justification, but why does he matter, do you think, in the present?
I mean, almost every day there's some storyline in the Errol book which is in the papers today. There's a real sense that the times that he lived in the 1930s and the 1940s are repeating in many ways. So all kinds of storylines keep coming back. So I think it's really important to understand that history, and it allows us a way into that. I mean, that's sort of on a global level. And then there's the more personal stories where I think we need to know about these stories. I mean, it's an amazing thing. It's like, why that whole image of Errol Flynn, like, why has the trial fallen out of the image of him? Like, it was so heavily covered, and then why do so many people not know about it? And I think that that's something which, you know, I'm trying to remedy. I think it's really important to own that history and to understand it, and hopefully not repeat it.
So, I mean, you were researching this book, you know, when Me Too took off around the globe. I mean, did that influence the way you saw that episode in 1942, 43 and the broader story of Errol Flynn?
I mean, I guess when I started, I mean, I didn't set out to write a book about someone who violated girls. I didn't. I mean, I was writing about this famous Australian that Americans didn't know was Australian, and because he'd had this Pacific life as well, that was what interested me. But I guess it was, and the reason why I started looking into the trial around the time of the Me Too movement is because the Taotai book had come out in 2017, and so I was moving back to Errol because I had to put Errol down in order to finish the book on Ta'isi O.F. Nelson. And so I just happened to be delving into the trial, and when I started reading the accounts of it, I was like, wow, this is an incredible episode. The trial was, you know, a phenomenal episode. And it wasn't so much what was happening in those conversations in Hollywood. It was more what I was reading about the evidence and the conduct of the trial that really made me want to research it more and go down that path.
Thanks, Patty. So please, if you've got any questions, please come down to the microphones and don't be shy.
I heard a rumour, or maybe it's not a rumour, that Errol Flynn spent quite a bit of time in North Queensland before he went to Papua New Guinea, and he was on cane farms up there. Have you got any information?
Yeah, I think he mentions in his autobiography, which we didn't really talk about.
My Wicked, Wicked Ways.
His ghostwritten autobiography. Yeah. He does talk about his final trip out of Australia. In 1933, he has a brief sojourn in Queensland. I don't think he was there for very long.
Did the writing of the book make you think about the evolution of Hollywood portrayal of masculinity over time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, quite a bit. Yes, I talk about that quite a bit. Because he's the first action hero. He's the first action hero. There's several Hollywood actors of today who look back at, you know, have named Errol Flynn as sort of like, you know, this person that they want to emulate, not in every way.
Being
yeah, but a lot of people I don't think appreciate that, you know, they don't know the story. So that dark side's been forgotten. So the masculinity that he portrays is a very physical one. And also a lot of his films, they're very self-referential. You know, there's a lot of jokes in there about, you know, he plays characters who are shy with women and things like that, which would have been hilarious, you know, and things like that. But then as he ages and weathers, he plays broken down characters. So, and he's not very old, he's in his 40s when he's in pretty bad shape. And so that's a different type of masculinity that he portrays.
And you suggest towards the end of the book that he didn't have to act very hard in order to play those characters.
No, because yeah. he was an alcoholic and an addict, a drug yeah. addict at the time.
All you got to do is act naturally, as Ringo Starr said, I guess. Yes, over to you.
Were you able to have any contact with his daughter when you were writing the book? And secondly, what sort of started the whole Charles Higham case to prosecute? He was a Nazi spy.
Yes, I did get in touch. So Errol had four children and two daughters are still with us. And I did contact... There's one daughter who's quite prominent in terms of, you know, burnishing her father's legacy, and that's Rory. And I did get in touch with her and tell her I was writing a book, and she went, "Oh, great, the more the merrier." And that was kind of it. So the other question... Higham, yes.
So you deal with this in the book?
Yes, I do talk about that. It's quite a convoluted story. Yeah. But his daughters were very active in trying to bring... You know, they felt that their father had been defamed. This book that comes out in 1980, and they actually sued Charles Higham, but the case is unsuccessful because the determination is that you can't defame a dead person.
So the accusations? The accusations were
that Errol Flynn was a Nazi spy, and that is the way that Higham builds that case. It all hinges around this friend that Errol made in New Guinea, Austrian doctor, Hermann Urban, who was a tropical medicine doctor. And they had this friendship where they travelled together, and they also had this trip to war-torn Spain in 1937. And Charles Higham builds all this case around not much evidence, and where there was a lack of evidence, he kind of made some up. I think there was a lot of reliance on informants who couldn't be found, documents that were heavily redacted, and there were a couple of historians who went back and looked at everything and went through and basically debunked the whole book. But the damage to Errol Flynn's reputation in 1980, I mean, even though the book, I mean, it's a hilarious read, actually. I mean, it's so dramatic, and it's there's a fabulous line which I remember where he said he played tennis like he made love or something like that, which conjures up awful images of him doing something to a net or something. I don't know. Or a racket. I don't know. But I was just like, oh, what a weird thing. But anyway, but it's a funny book. And Tasmania is like Austria in the 1930s. Yeah, it was so... I actually found it funny. So I was amazed when people still believed that Errol Flynn was a Nazi spy, and it's still something that people think is accurate. And he didn't only say he was a Nazi spy; he also said he was a homosexual. Yeah.
So he invaded Poland or something.
No. Yeah, but that too was sort of he had all this evidence of people who couldn't be found, who had had these relationships. Mm. So these were things that his family took, you know, extreme exception to, and they were, you know, very, very upset about, you know, what happened to Errol as a result of that. But I talk about some interesting sort of outcomes of that. You know, it's a really interesting story, and Errol had an incredible afterlife.
I mean, again, a kind of an interesting aspect of the politics of reputation here, that he's sullied by these effectively manufactured allegations in a book from 1980, and yet, as you pointed out, the events of 1942 barely figure in either, you know, his reputation or the defence of it, or any need to defend it later on. It's as if they didn't happen.
Yeah.
Thank you for an interesting talk, Patricia. For my sins, I went to the same school as Errol Flynn in Sydney, but about 50 years later. And there was quite a legend about the reason that Errol Flynn was expelled from the school.
Yes.
That was still sort of, you know, quite actively sort of discussed and things within the school 50 years later. Mm. Are you aware of the story?
I went to school up the road. I knew a lot of Shaw boys, so I know about the rumours, yes.
Are they true?
You better, could you share them? It's a bit cryptic for our...
Okay, so what Errol Flynn said that he got expelled from Shaw because he was jumping out of the dorm... He was a boarder and he was jumping out of the dormitory window and having relations with the schoolmate. But he actually left Shaw because his father had financial problems. His father had this scheme where he was trying to build up fisheries in Tasmania and had sunk all this money in, and the scheme wasn't working, and Theodore was trying to get Errol graduated from high school and put him in Shaw, and Errol left. And he does say in a letter to his father later, "I left, you know, because you were up to your neck in debt," or something like that. But it was basically, it's not a very glamorous reason. And I know that the Shaw boys aren't going to like that story because it doesn't kind of fit the legend. But it was, you know, the reason why a lot of people leave private school is because they can't afford it.
It's a comprehensive biography. Errol Flynn, the true story of Australia's Hollywood icon. It's by Georgetown University Professor Patricia O'Brien, and she was speaking with Professor of History Frank Bongiorno as part of the Meet the Author series at the Australian National University, and thanks to them. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and Errol Flynn is just, of course, one Australian actor who's made it big in Hollywood. What is it about Australian cinema talent? That was discussed in an earlier Big Ideas conversation. Here's essayist and writer Sam Twyford Moore and TV director Graham Thornburn, who have some ideas.
Is it true that you watched over 50 Errol Flynn movies in consecutive order as part of your research?
Yeah. The methodology of the book was I wanted to watch all of the movies, and I wanted to try and watch them chronologically so that it sort of became... Because essentially the book is a group biography and it's a work of biography or group biography. And I wanted to watch the movies chronologically so I could watch the person age and mature and sort of have career fellow points and high points and kind of map that out in the writing. Yeah, I definitely watched at least 50 Errol Flynn movies. I think there's 56 all up. Uh-oh. I don't think I skipped any, so it must have been 56, yeah.
Wow. Is there a medal for that?
One that I pinned on my own chest, maybe.
Yeah. No, right. Just to pick one thing, how the hell did he go from being a gold miner and a fraudulent patrol officer in New Guinea in 1929 to starring in Captain Blood in 1935 with no acting training? How do you make that transition?
Well, he ended up having a bit of acting training. He starred in one film in Australia, and this is sort of the kind of repeating story of Australian actors, is they might star in one or two things here and then they're not seen elsewhere in the world. So Errol Flynn made one film with Charles Chauvel called In the Wake of the Bounty. It's a terrible movie, really strange movie. It's a half travelogue non-fiction documentary of Chauvel and his wife travelling to the Pitcairn Islands, and then half the story of the mutiny on the Bounty kind of put together. It's a bit of a mess, but it obviously just never showed overseas.
And it was later plundered, wasn't it? They split it.
Yeah, MGM for their version of Mutiny on the Bounty with Clark Gable. Mm. They bought the footage to use for a trailer, but obviously cut Errol out of it. But Errol ended up going back to PNG after that for one last try to make his fortune and then failed. And then he went to England and he ended up on stage in England. He joined a repertory theatre, but he really wanted to be an actor, like a film actor. And so the thing about Errol is his life was filled with lies, but there's a kind of myth about him that he came from nowhere and that he had no sort of past. And he was discovered out of nowhere, but he worked really hard to get discovered. His mum was actually driving him up to the front door of the Warner Brothers studio in London, and he was knocking on their door. He was taking full-page advertisements out for himself. You know, he was doing everything he could to get noticed. It just happened to be when he did get noticed, it was a pretty quick campaign to get him into Captain Blood, which the Bounty movie is 1933 and then Captain Blood's 1935. So it's a pretty quick turnaround to becoming probably the biggest star in America.
Mm-hmm. He worked as a model briefly, didn't he?
He worked as a model in Sydney. He was showing off suits. You know, he'd try his hand at anything. He was a journeyman until he settled on being a big movie star.
You talked about he got some training. What training did he get?
I think he definitely got training from being in the theatre in London. Mm-hmm. I think he was just doing sort of classic plays. And, you know, you can really see he's so terrible in The Wake and The Bounty. He's so nervous. He's sort of like, you can see the lines that he has to recite kind of going through his brain. And then, you know, really just 2 years later, he's so effervescent and confident in Captain Blood. He's just, you know, the very definition of a matinee idol. And there's really 18 months between that. And what did he do? He was on the stage in London in front of pretty small audiences probably, but cutting his teeth properly.
Bette Davis didn't rate him much, did she?
No, she was really disappointed when she found out he was her co-star. And it was the old, you know, it's kind of, writing about Flynn is to write about movie stars when they were the stable players of the studios. They would only make movies for the studios. So Errol was exclusively a player for Warner Brothers, as was Bette Davis. So when they were put together as stars, they didn't have any say in it. And Bette Davis was horrified. She was just like...
What was the film?
The film was The Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex. It's actually a really good film, and Bette Davis hated being with Errol and slapped him about quite a bit, actually. And then on camera, and he would get stung and then go throw up in the bathroom, apparently. But she came to watch it later in life and went, oh, my goodness, he was actually brilliant. So Errol was someone who was underestimated, I think, at the time, but people kind of reassessed him later.
Do you think it's a sort of a parallel to the famous Laurence Olivier, Marilyn Monroe, Prince and Showgirl, where Olivia, who's driving the whole film, starring in the film, and just complaining in the rushes that she's blowing him off the screen?
Very much the same. And actually, funnily, I don't think I put this in the book, but Bette Davis was campaigning to get Olivia in The Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex. She wanted him rather than Errol, and he was the kind of watermark for her. So, yeah, but she ended up with Errol and they just had a horrible time together.
I want to move on from Errol in a second. One of the things in watching all those films, I mean, famously, he was self-destructive in so many ways. What's the tension between his growing ease with the process and presumably continuing to get better as an actor, and at the same time he's becoming a drunk and an alcoholic and really unreliable? Can you see that on screen?
No, definitely. There was a core tension inside him where he actively wanted to be a better actor. He wanted to take it seriously, but he was incredibly self-destructive and, you know, towards the end was drinking, you know, vodka in the morning, sort of, you know, really lived, didn't leave any moment unlived in a way, and destroyed himself and his acting in the process. He's really good. There's a movie where he plays John Barrymore, who was one of his idols. And he's really good in it. And there were three movies at the end, including that John Barrymore movie, and he was in the Hemingway adaptation of The Sun Also Rises. And in all of those, he was playing a drunk, and he was really good at it. He had a bit of experience at it, I'd say. And, you know, his personal life was all over the place as well. So, but that's there. That tension is definitely there. And then I think part of that depreciation is also when he sort of does start going downhill, it is those early movie stars aging and the studios not quite knowing what to do with them when they get to that age. And so he ended up repeating a lot of the performances and as a, you know, really out of shape 40-year-old, you know, in his 40s, because he was dead by 50. He was playing a lot of the Robin Hood roles again, but they just were, he was slowed up and not giving it his all. So It was partly the studios doing too.
Essayist and writer Sam Twyford Moore and TV director Graeme Thornburn. And to hear more of this great conversation on the rise of Australians on the big screen, we'll link to it in the show notes for this episode. Don't forget to follow Big Ideas on ABC Listen. Just get the mobile app. It's free. Search for Big Ideas. Hit the love heart to stay in touch with our 4 new episodes every week. And to get in touch with us, email bigideas@abc.net.au. You can find Big Ideas wherever you get your podcasts, by the way. I'm your host, Natasha Mitchell. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.